Joining us on this segment of Radio Parallax is Dr. Tony Held, coming to us from the California Air Resources Board. Tony got his Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Texas at Austin, and here at UC Davis obtained his Master's and PhD in Civil and Environmental Engineering. Welcome, Tony.
Well, thanks for having me, Doug.
I can do Tony instead of Dr. Held, I presume.
Yeah, you sure can. And also, I don't work, I'm not ARB, I'm a UC Davis.
Oh, but you're doing research for the ARB.
Correct.
Okay, well, I want to make sure we get that straight. Well, I guess the question I would like to start with, it's something that that all of us, I think, can relate to, that today it's in August, and people watching the nightly news see the air hazard warning or the air index is such and such, and most of us really don't have a good feel for what that's all about.
Well, Doug, I can tell you a little bit about it. Basically, those air quality indexes are born out of an EPA approach to try to quantify the air quality in a number that incorporates all sorts of different pollutants at once. Because when you talk
what would be like the big three?
Well, the big three, people would probably say, well, there's not quite three. There's a couple more. But you figure you have carbon monoxide, ozone, you have particulate matter, oxides of nitrogen, VOCs, which are volatile organic carbons.
That's like the stuff when you do your barbecue grill.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. When you use a barbecue, you use naphthalene, which is lighter fluid, which is just basically high energy, high inflammable.
And a lot of gasoline. it just evaporates basically in effect.
Before it even hits the Homer Simpson like barbecue.
when you're very up on this, of course, you know more than probably the average weatherman, obviously spewing out what's going on. Do you get worried when you see some of these numbers?
Well, I do. I ride my bicycle from the UCD Med Center, which is in Sacramento, to UC Davis. And if you're going to go an hour...
Every day?
No, I don't. Okay. Often. Well, okay. Not as often as I should say. And you see that the air quality is hazardous to sensitive populations.
Yeah.
And you know that you're going to be riding on the causeway next to cars.
Yes.
In 110 degree heat. It gets your attention as maybe this is not such a good idea to do. So it definitely does influence behavior. And I think all of us, when we go along and, you know, the causeway is the easiest place to look at air quality, because if you can't see the Sierra Nevadas at all, you know you're in trouble. And if you can't see, you know, the other end of the causeway, you know you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
So looking at the air, it's a pretty good indicator of the particulate matter concentration, which is probably one of the most cutting edge topics in air quality research, because it's been shown to be so influential on mortality and morbidity.
Now, every so often I make that ride myself, and I am impressed by the fact that after you've gone, I guess it's like a 4 mile stretch where you're next to the cars, three
Correct.
Or four, where you're actually right next to the cars in the causeway. And I noticed that my face is greasy. It's got junk on it.
Well, that might have happened prior to riding your bicycle along the causeway. But I don't think the grease loading is coming from the cars, unfortunately.
Okay. I don't know whether it's coming out of the exhaust. And it's a 17 or 19 mile trip. Maybe I can't blame it all on the causeway,
sure,
but you know.
I don't think that's your primary concern next to the roadway. Although for those around you, it might be an important consideration.
Uh-huh.
Basically, when you look at those air qualities, they try to give you a number between typically 1 or 0 and 300. You're never going to see 0.
Okay, now, I really don't. Yeah, I mean, you see this number. Today's a 150. Today's a 100. Well, how do we make sense out of that?
Well, so there's an index where if it falls between 0 and 50, that's considered good. And if it falls between 50 and 100, that means moderate. Now, these are the EPA's numbers, and California might be slightly different. But it's all similar, very similar approach.
50. Say it's a 50. At 50, that means it's pretty darn good air. And you wouldn't worry about your causeway ride. You'd be out on a bicycle, and
you wouldn't worry
at all.
In terms of what the index is supposed to represent, and that is It's giving you a useful measure of the violation of national ambient air quality standards. So the EPA has set up 6 or 7, depending on how you look at it, standards for certain aspects of air quality, including what the carbon monoxide concentration is.
You're getting like so many points for carbon monoxide, so many points for ozone, so many points for particulates. Exactly.
It's a way of weighting it that would just consider it a useful measure of overall air quality.
All right. And you said it's, of course, weighted in terms of what people fear the most. So I presume carbon monoxide is number one on the list?
Or? It's not fear-based. All the air quality standards are based on health, and the standards are set for sensitive populations. So in theory, the regulations, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, are designed so that a sensitive population, for instance, let's say an asthmatic elderly person,
right,
could go out into the atmosphere and not feel undue strain or any health consequences due to breathing ambient air. So that's what the standards are based on, protecting sensitive populations within a certain amount of safety factor as well.
What's the cutoff of someone, an elderly asthmatic? What number should they not start to worry?
Well, luckily you picked CO, which is not a problem in Sacramento right now.
Okay.
Probably where you're going to have the most violations around here would be particulate matter.
But in terms of the index, I mean, what index? Okay, I'm an elderly person. I'm an asthmatic. My lungs aren't so good. What number should I start worrying about?
Well, first off, you should probably go by what your doctor says more than weatherman's
that's
index.
That's worthless because I'm a doctor and I don't know what to tell them.
Oh, okay.
So I've got to ask you.
So I would recommend first consulting a doctor on that. But I would then follow party line with what the Air Resources Board, who's put considerable study into this.
And the party line is?
I mean, you can look at the air quality alerts on the ARB website. You can become part of the mailing list there at their site as well. And if it says very unhealthy, they give you an entire list of things that you should not do that day. Avoid outdoor exertion if possible. Combine your errands on a separate day. And they give good advice on how to reduce your exposure and how to reduce your contribution towards air quality problems that day. www.arb.ca.gov. That stands for Air Resources Board, California.gov.
All right. Well, hopefully people that want more information can certainly do that.
Oh, there's all sorts of gems there at the Air Resources Board website.
I guess most people, I don't know whether people who are really with chronic lungers and, you know, chronic bronchitis, people with emphysema, whether they really tune into this or not. My concept is that people aren't that dialed into like paying attention to this.
You probably should be. Some of the initial air quality standards were set not on direct lab studies, that they were done indirectly. For instance, in LA area, they figured out, well, how many or what was the concentration of ozone that resulted in increased asthma attacks of school children. And so they started playing with the numbers in that way. So some of the initial air quality standards were based basically on aggregate health statistics. So they do have
trial and error. It was a smoggy day, and how many kids went to the doctor?
Oh, I wouldn't say trial and error. I would say number crunching and analysis,
right? Okay.
Because it's difficult to simulate some of these things in a realistic.
I guess when I say trial and error, knowing that LA on some days is looking like, you know, a scene from hell, like Dante's Inferno. I remember in '82, I was down. Up to that point, had been the worst smog day in Los Angeles history, and it was something to behold. It looked like something out of a future movie, you know.
It can look like a forest fire around LA sometimes.
It was all cars.
But to some extent, the air quality has improved, depending on what metric or what way you use to describe the air quality in LA, which is staggering because the vehicles mild traveled, which is popularly called VMT, has increased significantly in the LA area and pretty much all over California. And also the population has gone up. So to think that even the if you stay at an even air quality over a 20-year period, that means that you're introducing quite a lot of technology and reduction approaches that are working.
Catalytic converters. What's responsible for LA not being a hellhole? Or not being like Mexico City, for example?
Well, there's a lot of things. First off, the catalytic converter you mentioned is a really good way to remove some of the primary pollutants coming out of vehicles, which would include oxides of nitrogen, carbon monoxide and volatile organic carbons. So, and they're called VOCs. VOCs are basically, you can think of gasoline that didn't get fully combusted. Mm-hmm. So it just basically passes out your car in some state. And so these catalytic converters do a good job at converting these into less toxic air equivalents. And also, the fuels were modified in the 70s, 1970. You know, you'd have actual lead in your gasoline. So the lead is added as a performance enhancer, an anti-knock agent that's put into your car. And so some people said, well, you know, this causes reproductive harm, which are referred to as teratogens, and this causes all sorts of, mental retardation in children. Maybe we should pick something else as our, you know, anti-knock additive.
I see us heading for the quicksand right now.
Yeah. So it was a good idea to remove lead, and people were really behind it, you know.
But?
No, it's a really good idea.
But what about the fact that we've got MTB, I guess, in there, and people are not so happy about this now?
Well, you know, this would be nice and fun and controversial, but...
I know you don't speak for UC Davis or the Air Resources Board, but
let's make that clear.
MTB, you know, like, here a little bit.
Now, there's a variety of people in the department that I work in who specialize in MTBE, and they know rings more about this than me. But basically, MTBE is something that is highly mobile and in the ground. Mm-hmm. And so if you have an underground storage leak of your gasoline, it's able to penetrate through the soil much faster than your other components of gasoline. And the other trick about MTBE is humans are very sensitive to the taste of it. It can be detected in almost parts per trillion, I think.
Really?
I may not be exactly right on that. And so in a sense, right, the early indicator is that people drink their water and it tastes funny, right? Huh. Well, it's definitely not as toxic as having a single beer. If you consider the amount of carcinogenic effect of MTB in your water, it is scads lower than one glass of wine or one beer.
Really? So perhaps the big flap over MTB is a little bit overdone.
Well, it depends on what your point of view is. Uh-huh. If you're using MTB as an early indicator of, well, we've got all these leaky underground storage tanks, mm-hmm. let's do something about it. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that they put MTBE into fuel is that you get more complete combustion in the vehicle. So in a sense, MTBE, in addition to having the fuel or the hydrocarbons in it, it also contains a little oxygen, which is going to reduce your ultimate concentrations of ozone. And ozone has traditionally been the most focused on air quality metric. People think of smog is synonymous with just ozone, and you can interrelate the two. Mm-hmm. Now with all sorts of recent medical and epidemiological studies indicating that particulate matter are ultra-fine particulate matter. So we're talking about solids and liquids in the air, so fine that you can't see, mm-hmm. but they turn out to have a significant health impact.
Get way down into your alveoli and stay there, I guess.
Exactly. Okay. So your alveoli are...
But like a coal miner in West Virginia or something.
You know, you can end up with damage, uh-huh. Fibrosis, all sorts of other problems in your lungs. But the interesting thing about particulate matter is the toxicological pathway is not all that well understood. We know that it's bad for you, and if you're in this environment, that it can lead to health problems.
Yeah.
But we're not quite sure exactly how. In much the same way, we know that aspirin makes you feel better,
yes,
but some of its pathways are...
Welcome to the world of medicine.
Yeah, there you go.
I do remember when we were first working on cadavers, and we got down to looking at actual lung tissue in dead people. It was obvious that many of them had a sort of a peppery look. They had a lot of obvious particulate matter in their lungs, and the instructor said, you can tell where people lived. These people lived in an urban environment. It shows up in their lungs.
Sure. Well, if you're a coal miner and you do have, you know, black lung,
terrible,
you can identify it quite easily, I would assume. But as long as we're talking about lungs and air quality, one of the interesting aspects of these air quality indexes are if you took cigarette smoke, which has about 400 parts per million, which is a unit of concentration or so, in each puff coming out of the end of the cigarette, not the secondhand part, but going through the filter, It also contains a lot of particulate matter, significant concentrations of formaldehyde, and all sorts of other things that you wouldn't willingly put into your body unless you were getting something out of it, typically. If you put just the carbon monoxide on the EPA's air quality index, you'll end up with an air quality value not of 0 to 50 or 150 or 200. You end up with an air quality index of about 4,000.
Smokers, take note.
I'm not saying that smoking is 1,000 times worse for you than, you know, breathing the air around you, but just to show you that the indexes that we're using just don't even compensate for the level of, you know, environmental exposure that you're going to have through one cigarette.
Yeah.
That when we're talking about protecting sensitive populations, if you had them in a room full of cigarette smoke, the air quality in that city would be considered abysmal, probably worse than anywhere in the world if you just had them in a room full of smoke with cigarettes.
Now, before the show, you mentioned something I thought was very interesting that about smoking and flying regards to this.
This is something a little dear to my heart. My sister's a flight attendant, and it's actually part of the reason that you cannot smoke on domestic flights are that the flight attendant guilds petitioned that the air in an airplane should be considered a workspace for them.
Yeah.
And so they're successful. Yeah, well, they're in this environment. They're performing their work duty, and this is the air they get to breathe. Well, it turns out that they won, and then they were qualified to be protected by OSHA, the Occupation Safety and Health Administration. And OSHA said, well, the only way that we can have the air clean enough so that it meets OSHA standards to protect the workers are not to have people smoke,
right,
because the filtration systems weren't effective. And if you had to walk around in the smoking sections, other than putting full respirators on the flight attendants, you couldn't make the air clean enough to breathe.
Right. And well, having a smoking section in an airplane, that's kind of like having a peeing section in a pool.
Yeah. It's difficult to separate the smoke and keep it from going.
You know, for the as we so often like to take pot shots at, you know, meddlesome government bureaucracy, it seems to me that OSHA getting involved and keeping people from smoking on domestic flights was one heck of a good idea. Bless those meddlesome bureaucrats.
Talking about flying, most of us do our transportation on the ground. And here in the Sacramento Valley, we consider Greater Sacramento just the county of Sacramento. There's about in the year 2000, about 1.3 million of us here in the Greater Sacramento area. And we can estimate, based on vehicle use option statistics and sorts of surveys, how many vehicles per mile travel there are in the entire Sacramento area for any given day. What conceptually would happen if we took everyone in all of Sacramento, restarted their odometers, let them drive around how they were during the day, and then sum up every single vehicle. And the ones that didn't move, zero, and then the other ones that did move, we just sum up their calculation. In Sacramento today, there was about 30 million vehicle miles traveled.
Yikes.
Is quite a lot. If you think about, we're just talking about the Sacramento area, Sacramento County area.
That's a lot of cars pointing through a lot of miles of atmosphere, spewing noxious gases out the exhaust pipe.
So if you assume a fuel efficiency, which would be high, 5 miles per gallon for this group, then over in a year, in Sacramento area alone, it can consume over a half a billion gallons of gasoline. So that's a lot of gasoline. So if you think about it, essentially what we're doing is we're taking a half a billion gallons of gasoline, putting it in a pool, walking it's quite an inferno out there. It's just low-speed fuel combustion going on at all times in our atmosphere.
Well, how can we get people out of their cars? It all comes down to, like, air quality all comes down to cars and trucks. So what can we do? We've been talking, when I was a student at Davis, we were talking about the obvious answer was more mass transit, but for America seems to have not gone in that direction.
People, by and large, don't like mass transit to some extent, and they have their own grievances, and some people love it and use it faithfully. In general, people would use mass transit all the time if it showed up right in front of their house at any arbitrary time and dropped them off wherever they wanted to go nonstop and then did the return trip the same, just like a car. But if they have to walk, you know, a mile to the light rail and then a bus from here to there.
You can't walk. This is America.
Yeah, that's too much for them. So people do not like the convenience factor or the perceived convenience factor. Mm-hmm. I myself, if I'm not going to ride to school, I can take a shuttle that goes directly from the Med Center to UC Davis.
Right.
And it's 20 minutes where I don't have to drive. I don't have to pay any money. And I get to sit on a nice bus with an air conditioner and, you know, pleasure read, which to me is nicer than sitting in stop and go traffic. So in terms of what's the heavy hitter for the air quality, it's almost always, depending on what pollutant you're going to have, it's almost always going to be car related.
Well, Dr. Tony Hale, what can we do about reducing all these VMTs and improving our air quality?
Well, there's a variety of things you can do. The first is you can exercise your power as a consumer. Fuel manufacturers, the oil industry, and cars aren't going to listen to certain peoples unless they're putting their money where their mouth is. For instance, I'm looking at a list of what consumers rank as their principal concerns when buying a car.
Oh, no.
This is a study. So number one is reliability, and number two, well-made vehicle. Mm-hmm. Fuel economy is right around number 25.
Really?
That's right.
Really?
That's right after number 22, which is interior styling, right?
Oh, so, my God.
In terms of
I'm appalled.
Where people are putting their money, people are not telling car industries that, hey, you know, I don't want the better fuel economy. Right. I don't want, you know, this.
Detroit ain't hearing this.
This leather, you know, like gas cap, you know, nozzle, you know. I want a fuel, you know, a fuel economy that I can live with.
Well, this is about time. We got to repaint that picture. The Kuwaiti oil fields burning 500 million gallons a year. Think about this, folks.
So you can also reduce the amount of fuel that you personally use. You can do things like carpool. When you see people, if you go up snowboarding on a work day and you see everyone driving in from Roseville to Sacramento, they're all single vehicle, you know, single person in a single vehicle. If, you know, just 20% of those people, you know, carpooled, you can have an amazing reduction in the amount of traffic and also emissions and fuel usage.
Carpools were big for a while. They seem to kind of be being out of vogue at this point. People are not talking carpools. I don't hear a lot of talk about it anymore.
Well, they should, because carpools are a great idea, especially when you've got a whole bunch of people starting at the same point and ending at the same point, and there's a significant commute along the way. They're a great idea. And you can also change your lifestyle to an extent. You can ride your bike, which is nice to be outside, and go to your Crest Theater or the, you know, wherever you want to go for your entertainment,
right,
without driving your car there. And then, hey, you know, you don't have to go to the gym anymore because now you're riding your bike for your exercise.
Well, as an old Davisite, I certainly put into practice the old Aggie method of getting around a bicycle as much as possible, and I certainly agree with you on that one.
Sure. And so if there was enough people biking, there'd be more bike lanes, and there'd be you know, more resources to put into more environmental sources of transportation. If more people said, hey, you know, like, I don't want a vehicle with 10 miles per gallon. I want a light rail closer to my and take me wherever I want to go. And as a society, we decide that that's where we want to put our interest. Well, then we can make these sorts of transportation options viable. We can start to make a significant impact, and maybe one of these days in the midsummer we can look on the causeway and see the Sierras again, which would be quite nice.
Yes, it would.
And a lot of times when we talk about what is more cost effective, or, you know, which is a more expensive solution, we fail to take in the complete cost of some project. For instance, if we talk about, well, what's the cost of having people be able to drive their cars around, we're not calculating any aesthetic cost of having diminished visibility or have certain sensitive habitats being destroyed.
Yeah.
So we're not taking the full cost all the way through and putting that on the point of the consumer to be able to purchase and make informed decisions. My girlfriend, who's also a air quality specialist, she has often said that, how come you can just create an insecticide, sell it as a can, and then that's the end of the responsibility for the manufacturer? How come they don't have to take responsibility for the disposal of the can,
the
potential environmental impacts of that particular toxin you put in your your can. And then society, in a sense, has to pay for that in land waste disposal and other sorts of buried costs.
Right.
So if we shift towards putting the cost on the consumer, then the consumer will naturally make an environmental solution because they have all the information in a level playing field.
A great flaw I see in modern economics is that it does not take into account, for example, that you've got a nice view and you've got a nice forest next to you, whereas it does account things in like the gross domestic product of like, you know, the cost of cleanup of an oil spill is considered a plus.
Correct.
You're spending money and the economy's working.
It goes down to how an economist would define a forest as unused timber.
It only has value to you when you're hammering nails into it.
Correct. And that's a societally capitalistic view, you know, on that particular aspect.
Thank you very much for coming on, and I think we've cleared up a few issues for the public.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, and I just want to leave you with the thought that you can reduce your own fuel consumption, you can make a difference tomorrow based on how you drive around or choose not to drive, and if you're thinking about buying that car, maybe take a look at the fuel economy.
All right.